Street, and her mother's maiden name was Bob, and they were from Switzerland. And they came here in about 1872, I believe. And so there have been people descended from there living here ever since. Since I was married in 1961, I've been here this fall. It was 54 years that I've lived here on the farm.
And your family, but you would visit me.
I came here every summer and begged to stay. I never wanted to go back to this city. I was raised in Cleveland, Ohio, and although it was lovely at the time and a nice place to be, I was a Helvetia girl all my life. I always wanted to live here and never thought I could, so it was like a dream come true to be able to live here. Well, we had a dance probably every Saturday night, or it seemed like that. We had a lot of dancing. There were community picnics. Church was fun. Working on my grandmother and grandfather's farm, it never seemed like work to me. I mean, I got hot and I got tired and I got sunburned, but I didn't care because I liked it that well. So I'd say the Swiss events at the time and the dancing was the best recreation. That's what I really liked. My rake hay, they made hay with horses, no tractor or anything. So the kids would end up going out and raking the hay into hay shops so that it could dry after it was dry, and then they'd pick them up and make hay stacks with it or put them in the barn. And we went from farm to farm, whatever little neighborhood of Helvetia you lived in, four or five farmers always helped each other. And so you got to know the other kids, and you go swimming, the river was right there. And it was just very wholesome, and there was a lot of fun. Oh, my grandmother made wilted lettuce salad. We had that a lot because she had a big garden. She was quite a gardener. Salsify, which is oyster clam. A lot of vinegary dishes, I remember that. I just loved the vegetables. They all had so much good taste and life to them because I was used to eating bought canned vegetables. Made all the difference. And my aunt lived with my grandparents at the time, and she was quite a baker. And she would make rosettes in the summertime, and we would help her. And I can remember when I was 9, she asked me what kind of birthday cake I wanted, and I wanted a chocolate cake with blue frosting and silver sprinkles on it. And she just shuddered and said, "Who would eat blue frosting?" But I got that for my 9th birthday. They smoked their own meat, their bacon, and they always had canned sausage balls. Which is a delightful food. Well, you season sausage and roll it into small meatballs and can it, and it makes its own broth. And then when you want to use them, you just open them up and take out, heat them up. That was pork. They can beef too, but I especially like the sausage balls. It's really good. And everybody around here had kind of their own, maybe their own formula of seasoning sausage, whether it was smoked or whether it was fresh. They seasoned it the same way, and so it was whatever the combination the family particularly liked, but it was mostly sage and major, maybe garlic, a lot of pepper, and some salt. That was the major thing. And when I made sausage myself, I didn't like sage as well as thyme, and it's in the same family, and I would put thyme in it. My grandmother was, in her family. My grandfather was Irish. she just cooked like her mother cooked, evidently. And of course, you know, you learn to cook what your kids will eat and all. And my grandmother, my great grandmother, evidently cooked with a lot of caraway seeds. And my mother, for the day she died, wouldn't eat anything with caraway seed in it. Even if you bought a good Russian bread, she would not eat caraway seed. She said, I had to even, my grandmother put it in everything. And I said, what do you mean everything? She said, carrots, for heaven's sake. And she just didn't like it, you know. So the only thing I put caraway seed is when I make rye bread. Rich people do this in a lot of recipes. Not so much. We didn't have, we always had, had a lot of cornbread at my grandmother's, and my mother was allergic to corn, so I never had the cornbread once or twice till I got married. And, you know, one of the dishes around here that has been popular forever was beans and cornbread. And after I was married about 3 years, I made beans and cornbread for supper one night, and my husband said, this is so good. This is wonderful. Why didn't you ever make it before? And I said, well, I never thought of it. Why? Well, it's one of my favorite things. And I said, why didn't you tell me? Come here. I should know that, you know. But my mother just, no, it was nothing fancy except dessert. And she learned to make desserts from the Slavic people in our neighborhood. So we had mostly Slavic-type, you know, pastries and things. Nut horns, it's a real buttery pastry that you make with a lot of chopped nuts in and roll it out like a pie dough and cut it in pie fashion, but out of a circle that would be like 12 or 14 inches around, you would make 40 slices in there. So then you roll them up and they made a little, like a croissant. And they're real good. And cream cheese pastries, just a lot of rich, nice things. But she, I can't remember, the only thing Swiss, and it's in our Swiss cookbook, is she made cream spinach. When we ate spinach, she would, in a skillet, take a little bit of maybe bacon grease and a little bit of flour, and then pour some of the spinach, and I don't think she put onions in it, a little bit of the spinach broth in that, and it wasn't like a soppy cream sauce. It was just that it had that in it. Yeah, sort of. Like a white sauce that was in it. But it wasn't, you know, like when you eat cream peas, there's more cream than there are peas. But in the spinach, it wasn't like that.
That's
good. When I fixed it here, my husband said, why did you do that? So evidently that wasn't anything he ever had at home, but my grandparents made it, my mom. I would say it has a little sugar. It's not real sweet like Jiffy mix.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like some southern cornbreads don't have any sugar, but this was a little bit. People don't put a lot of sugar, but it always has a little sugar in it. I would say dipping it, I like pancakes made out of it because I don't get along well with white flour, and so I just make pancakes, and everybody gets hungry.
And so you and your husband
cattle and had her own milk cow, and so she got with my husband all the dairy products and we raised sheep. And it was just a blend of all four animals, and then as we got older we didn't have cows because they're a little bit harder to handle, so we just raised sheep and used wool and had wool blankets. Yeah, we sold it to we sent it to McCarthy's Woolen Mill in Prince Edward Island. And it was a small concern, so it was real nice working with them. Mm-hmm. We did that for, I don't know, probably more than 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, we used it all. We always just had one milk cow. And whenever we had four kids at home, so there were six of us that were milk drinkers, and we drank over a gallon a day. And we had always had a good dairy cow, so we had a lot of cream, we had our own butter, we made Hocus cheese, we made cottage cheese, so it was, you know, it's an important staple for us. Worcestershire cheese is a hard cheese, kind of like Swiss cheese. It doesn't have big round holes in it like Swiss cheese. The holes are a little bit smaller. I've been told by people from Switzerland that it tastes like the cheese made in the very highest Alps. And so you will say you're going to make a 4-pound cheese or a 3.5 to 4-pound cheese, so you need about 5 gallons of milk. And in the evening, you would pour about 2.5 gallons of milk in a granite canner, a small granite canner. And, no, like a pot that was enameled with blue and white speckles.
Oh,
yeah. So you would put about 2.5 gallons of milk in there and set it where it would stay cool for the night. Not in the refrigerator, but cool. So in the morning you skimmed that off, the cream, you took the heavy cream off of that, as much cream off as you could get. And then you strained the morning's milk and put it in there. So you had half skim milk and half rich milk, and that's how you would make it. And you heat it without to like baby bottle temperature, I don't remember the temperature, but you heat it up to that. And you always were washed up to the armpits because you stirred it with your hand. You learn the feel of it with your hand. So you would heat it up that much and you would put rennet in it. And what rennet is made from is the lining of a calf's stomach that has never eaten grass. So the calf is still on its mother, you know, nursing on the mother. And that congeals it, and it gets thick in about an hour and a half, and then you cut it in 1-inch cubes, and so the curd starts to lift a little bit and loosen up, and the whey, you can see the whey, kind of the yellow milky whey, and then you stir it again with your hand for, it seemed like it was about 45 minutes, and I don't remember the temperature. It might have been 112 degrees, you know, 112, 120, I don't know. But you stir that, and if there were big clumps, you just mash them, kind of cut them with your finger and your thumb. And to test it, you would pick up a handful of curd and squeeze it a little bit, not hard, just so that it would go together, and shake it. And if it still came apart, but it was, you could tell it couldn't hold together, then you were done. And so you would stir it just a little, shut the fire off, stir it a little bit, and then separate the curd from the whey. You'd pour off the whey with a cheesecloth, and then you lined a cheese mold, which was usually made out of poplar. so it wouldn't have any taste to it. You lined that with cheesecloth, and then you lifted your curds out and put them in there, filled the corners, and put it in there and flopped the cheesecloth over it and put a block that fit down inside of your mold. That was to make the top mold. Mm-hmm. And so it had to drain for a long time. And at first, you either had a little stool that had a groove on the cheese board, you put the mold on that and it would drain into a can, or I just did it on my kitchen sink and just had a wooden drain thing to go into the sink. And you would usually leave it in the mold for overnight, or at least several hours, depending on what time of day you were making it. And then you took the cheesecloth off and rubbed it with not iodized salt, like cannon salt, kosher salt or something like that. You would rub that over it and set it on a plate and see if it was draining too much. You'd still leave it upstairs covered. But otherwise, you would put it in your cheese cupboard, and then every day you turned it, and that kept the confirmation of the shape.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to cure it, I'd say 3 weeks before you ate it, and you could keep it longer than that. But 3 weeks, it was good. It was ready to eat. It was hard. And some people actually put the salt in the curd instead of salting it, but I like to rub it on the outside because it seems to make a nicer rind. Everybody, I don't know anybody who didn't make cheese because it was so good.
Yeah.
And then people wanted to buy it. But whenever the early settlers made it, there were two or three cheese houses. One up here is right on Hilltop in Albuquerque, and that's a lovely place to go and see that. And then the Kaiser one is down, but it was down in Hilltop. And those farmers would put a branta, which is a tin, some kind of metal, I think it's tin, thing on their back. A rectangular bucket sort of that was 3 feet tall and about 8 inches wide, and it had a lid and it had straps on it. So if I was going to take my cheese and my milk over to Berkey's and sell them and let them make the cheese, then the man would strap it on his back and take the Brenta over there and pour it there. And that's, I guess they did that. Well, the early settlers, maybe that's just the best they could do, was do it in quantity. And then again, maybe they did it that way in Switzerland, so they just did it that way. And down at the museum, we have a couple branches up there, and I have one. I mean, they evidently, everybody who had to sell milk had them, because you see them, it's common here.
And why do you think that was the
recipe? Is that what people made in the Champagne? Yeah. Yeah. Up in the Simmental area of Switzerland, that's toward Bern, that's where most of the families from here came, from that area, and I guess that was just how they did it. And these people weren't farmers. I don't think anybody who came here was a farmer. They had a shoemaker and a milliner and a businessman and storekeeper and everything, but it's always been a subsistence. Always. Well, when you farm, you always sell the calves, in a year's time. If you sell them when they get to be, I forget what the weight is anymore, say 300 pounds, it's a veal, and you get a lot of money for that.
Mm-hmm.
You keep them for a year, you got way more weight on them, and then you get baby beef price, and with lambs, you sell the lambs. Oh, I guess they're 6 or 7 months old, and so you get a good price for the lamb. The wool isn't worth much, but you have to shear them, but you don't shear the lambs, And pigs were fun to raise. I love raising baby pigs. And you just got the same customers every year. They call up, do you have baby pigs? And it was was a wonderful way to raise kids. Living on a farm, they learn about life, they learn about death, and you know, the sorrow isn't the end of everything. It's just a good way to raise kids. I had four. Two boys and two girls. We both froze our meat in Kansas, and canned beef is just the gourmet object, if you ask me. And when I, well, how to can it? Okay. You would, some of your meat you would grind up, and usually we can some ground meat, and what we would do is just loosely put about 2 pounds of meat in a jar, and maybe a pinch of salt. And after the meat was in the jar, about not quite 2 inches of boiling water, and then you just process it. And now you would process it in a canner, in a pressure canner. And I've made sausage balls and meatballs, both. The meatballs I didn't season. I just made balls and browned them a little bit in canner. Mm-hmm. Sausage, when you're doing a pork, and we usually would butcher two at a time because we had a big family. And so you would cut up the meat however you wanted, and usually one shoulder, we would put one shoulder in because that made the sausage more lean, because you're using the scraps of the meat to make your sausage with. And then we would season it with thyme and pepper and maybe a little bit of sage and salt and margarine, and mix it up and just make little balls, and sometimes I'd brown them to put them in the jar and sometimes not, and you just process that too. And one thing that we really liked with beef was to make chunks, little, like 1-inch squares or 1.5 inches of stew meat, and can that, and then open it up and make gravy of it. And that was really good. A lot of people, John Christy did it here. Over Bud's mom, we did it though. Maybe because we were butchering every day when we were first married. They had a big 20-gallon crock, and you would put like your pork ribs and roast and chop down in the salt bag, and you didn't have to can it. It just preserves it. But as time has passed, that isn't as safe a way as it used to be to do it. One of my neighbors said, oh, well, we used to always just get steak out of the crock. And I said, what are you talking about? Well, they would slice the beef steak, the size, you know, piece steak size, because they wanted it, and they would put it in a crock, say, three-gallon crock, maybe, and they would put a little bit of grease in the bottom, and then they would put layers of steak, and then another layer of grease, and they would cap it off with grease, and that preserved it. And they could all year long put steak out of it. Yeah, so things have changed. I mean, I've been here 55 years now, and things that people did before I came here, I didn't do it, but now salting the pork, everybody did that. And they smoked, you smoked your bacon, you cooked the head and made mince meat with the meat off the head, because it's very good and tender. And that we would can. You know, you usually make 10, 12 jars of mince meat from one hog. Oh my, it's got a lot of stuff in it. Currants, apples or applesauce, sometimes pineapple chunks. A lot of spices. Some people put oranges in it, but my friend Jeremy and I decided sometimes that made it bitter. So we didn't do that. And sometimes raisins. Sometimes, if you didn't have enough corn, sometimes you would put raisins in it. And you'd grind up the meat. meat first and then mix it all with this. And then you cook it down in a pan, in like a big pan. Dutch oven is, well, bigger than that. Like in a can, and stir it in with wine. You put wine in it and cook it down in the wine and then canned it. And well, my son, which is my youngest son, open the jar and eat it with his spoon. You gotta watch it. Yeah, somebody said to me not long ago, I made a mincemeat pie and they said there's meat in there. I said, yeah? Why do you think they call it mincemeat? Well, all they had was that pie or my or whatever that you buy at the store. It's just fruit, you know, whole different thing. Well, you put so much salt, and it has to be a lot of salt. And the test of it to see if it's salty enough is you take an egg and see if it'll float. And when it floats, the piece of the egg showing through, it has to be the size of a nickel. That's the test for it. And that's the only part of salting I've ever done because our neighbor got bedfast, and they made his wife and I learn how to do that. You think that's enough? No, a little more. So everybody knows that because it wouldn't, you would ruin it otherwise.
Yeah.
You know. Butcher lamb for ourselves. I didn't like mutton. My grandparents used to cook mutton and I don't like it at all. But we would butcher lamb. Sometimes there were some people who wanted lamb. But then my oldest son Bruce liked lamb. And so every year after he was grown and working, he would buy 2 lambs and have them dressed the way he wanted to at the butcher shop. And an excellent lamb cook. And I like lamb. To make dolmas, you know, ground lamb, stuff like that. I like it, but there was no point in me butchering lamb and eating it myself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my husband was a fine butcher, and his dad, and there were people they just butchered for, you know, they just going. Usually, we would have a quart of vegetables, home canned vegetables, whatever, you know, whatever seemed like it would go with the meal. In the summertime, of course, it was fresh vegetables, a lot of fresh stuff. And we made our own bread. When I went to work, I went 1 year kind of, and then I was going to be hired back as a federal program, so at the school. And so I said, well, do you want me to work or don't work? Because I've only worked for 1 year. And so we had a little family meeting after we decided I was going to work. How were they going to help? How is everybody going to help and do stuff? And the kid said, we will do anything if you go back to making bread. And so everybody shared very well in the work, and we had fresh bread every week. Because
wow.
Bread, taking bread takes almost all day Saturday. You know. I would make white bread and rye bread. Primarily. Now I grind my own wheat and I make mostly whole wheat bread or barley bread. You know, and I'll put seeds in it, pumpkin seeds and sunflower seeds and maybe dried either raisins or I don't really like cranberries in it. And but homemade rye bread is just the best. Because it was healthier. And once you start eating whole wheat bread, you realize it's moist. It's more of a moist bread, white bread, even good homemade white bread tastes a little bit dry after that. So, but we always tried to do the most healthful eating that we could. We had everything ourselves. And at one point, one of my kids started getting headaches, and the school counselor, who was just a friend I was talking to, she said, "Do you ever happen to think?" Because it was when she went to town, she got a headache. But she didn't want to go shopping. And she said, "Do you ever think maybe it's preservative? Because you're going to get that at home?" That's what it was. Well, but I just didn't think about that. But I don't know. Growing up on a farm, we always had a big potato crop. So every night, almost every night, we had potato sticks one way or another. The potatoes grew so well up here on top of the hill that two or three farmers sold all the big potatoes to a restaurant in Clarksburg for French fries. Every Sunday was a special occasion. We always had a lot of company, or, you know, I'd go with my mother-in-law and help her cook or something. Fried chicken was an important thing. Home-cured ham was, I guess, the most special thing, because it was just so good. And it's a big piece of meat. It's going to serve many people. Always a salad, if it wasn't a season where you, because we didn't get lettuce and stuff real often, because we didn't go to town as much as we do now. And so if we didn't have a lettuce or a green salad, we would make a jello salad of some kind. You know, you could put celery or carrots or your carrots in it or something. And I'd always have a gallon of vegetables. Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, at that time, sunshine salad was pretty popular, and you would grate up, finely grate carrots and put it in either orange or lemon jello, and it made a good dish. Yeah. And then, for a while, the jello company made jellos that were savory. Oh my gosh, I don't know why they ever quit making them, because they were so good. And you could put in a cucumber or something, and it had several things in it, and maybe even it would be something like that with some walnuts in it. Really healthy things. But, I think everybody who came to eat on any of the farms was looking forward to warm bread or something. You know, either hot rolls or cornbread. Or fresh, like that. It was just, I mean, you had it. And so many people in town never made their own bread. But they had bakeries. They had good bakeries. When I lived in Cleveland, we could go get fresh ground sausage. My dad would go to the butcher shop, and I would go to the bakery. And, you know, it was just fresh and nice. Just like in Switzerland and Germany, every village has a butcher. To this day, every village has a baker. And they just do for the whole community, because I was asking one of the housewives where I was staying, "Well, do you make homemade bread?" And she said, "Oh, no." I mean, she just looked at me like, what a dumb thing to ask. Well, the baker bakes the bread. They don't do it. The baker just does. The biggest thing is in the spring, it's the ramp supper, and it's always the last Saturday in April. Now there are many festivals around there, many ramp dinners, but ours was Richwood and Helberson were the first two in the state of West Virginia. And early on, it was nothing to have 800 to 1,000 people come to a dinner, so that was a lot to fix for, you know, a community this size, but everybody worked on it, and so that was an important thing. And then in August, the third weekend in August, you would have a fried chicken. So it was a chicken supper. And that was to produce the income to put the fair on every year, the community fair. And we haven't had to do that recently. We weren't, it used to be kind of a homecoming thing. And then as people drifted away, moved away, we didn't do that the last 5 years. So now we do, like today, we did the Fosnot bakery. But I think there's the only ones I can think of that we do. Oh, now we do Swiss National Holiday, which is about the first weekend in August. And we grill bratwurst and have a hot brown mustard to goes with it and fresh vegetables. You can have a meatless plate. You know, meatless dish, just garden vegetables and dips and things like that. We buy it at our local butcher over in Beverly, Scammers Market. Yeah, and it's so good grilled. Oh.
Yeah.
I don't like it grilled, but I like it grilled. Heidi makes it from the Hilton. I would say it starts out with Coleman's mustard, you know, the hot mustard that you make Chinese hot rice. I would say that's the start of it, but I don't know what else is in it, but it's a brown mustard. And I think bratwurst just seems to a brown mustard. It doesn't have to be hot, just a brown mustard. Yeah, the Rail Supper, you get the ranch in March because you can't wait, you know, or the first week in April because depending what the winter's like, you can't use the ranch when they're not tender. So whenever the ranch come up and they start getting big enough, the people who dig the ranch for us will bring them in. And so you spend somewhere between a week and a half and 2 weeks washing and cleaning and blanching and freezing ranch. That's the big preparation. And then the day before the ranch supper, you go down and fry, I don't know how many pounds of bacon. It's chopped up bacon that goes in some of the beans, some of the fried potatoes. The ham. You get boneless hams and separate them out and get them laid out the next day to put in roasters on Saturday morning. And it's just very labor intensive, but it's delicious. Yeah. It's in the prime and bacon grease and rice. Yeah. It's not a heart healthy meal. But it sure is good. No, they usually put a few cups of bacon crackling in it. I don't think there's anything bacon. I don't think anything at our dinner would be healthy. Well, it's good. It really is good. We have, you know, for years people would come. The only time they came to help us was the ranch supper, but it was really, it was the best ranch supper around. It was good. And I think it's just because we didn't alter the recipe, we can think it's the same way for however long they've been having it, which would be probably 6 to 5, 7 a year, you know, for a long time. Because that was the good thing about that for us was that you could have one big thing a year from that would cover your expenses, like to run the community hall, to keep the lights on, to keep the heat on, to do repairs. So the farm women would partner with another group, usually the Hall Association, and then it was that was the main money maker for maintenance. And it took a lot of people to do it, and everybody was willing because that was the whole aim, was to be able to exist on that.
Right.
But you could have a lot of big sales and never come up with that kind of money.
Yeah.
Somewhere between 10 and 15 miles. Oh, it's all you can eat, and it's good. It's just good.
So, I know that the cookbook,
Go ahead, but help us.
So, I have a copy of that, but that was printed at the Centennial, is that right?
Yep. I don't know about the hoodwink, but I use it a lot, but, you know, and it makes a nice little present. It's not expensive, but it's quaint. It's got little jokes in it and sayings and home remedies, things like that. And it's some things you'd never use, but it's just a fun little book to have. Oh, yeah, you just got it from your family, you know, or your neighbor, you know, and everybody, every household that I know of was Swiss, you know, part of the family was Swiss, so they had all the recipes, you know. Now, Sandy's grandma made an excellent sweet bread, and Sandy's learned how to do it in the grade, so she's really worked at it, so I'm excited about that. I don't know if that's a cute little name.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, she thought everybody knew how to do that. Well, I never even heard of it. But maybe I've made sweet bread. And my grandmother gave me a sweet bread recipe, but she didn't call it anything. It was the beer recipe. You make a big recipe of dough, and you make fruit filling, and they call it's beer recipe, and it's... it was primarily dried pear, but we've made it with whatever we could get. You know, if it wasn't a good pear year, your pears you didn't bear that year, well, then what were you going to do? Well, you used apples, or you get some other kind of fruit, buy something. You know, I've had it where it had dried figs in it, and raisins, and lots of apples, you know. But the seasoning is what's good in it. You use cinnamon, oil, and anise oil. Really good. Yeah. Yes. Well, in here, Myrtle Turner's recipe is not a yeasted bread, but my grandmother's was yeasted. There again, it's probably because of the pantone, you know. But I learned to make it with yeast, and that's what I make it with. But Nancy brought me over a small loaf of bread 2 weeks ago, and she and Bunch made it, and it's not yeast. So you can do it either way. It just has to be sketchy and pliable because you roll it up jelly roll style. We'll have to eat again.
So how do you think people are eating now in the region?
I guess we have quite a mix of young families and old families here. We don't have very many people, so you can't say they belong. I personally cook every day. I don't like processed foods. I'd never go back to eating processed foods. Heaven forbid they put me in a place where I have to eat processed foods. But ever has a farm still makes their own meat in the garden. I mean, young couples or old couples, they wouldn't be living on a farm probably if they didn't want to use it, you know, make use of it. People butcher their own or buy from a neighbor who will butcher meat, you know, don't do that. Whoever does have a cow usually at least makes butter. Things have changed in the fact that young people, a lot of young people have had to move away because it used to be the coal mines and the sawmills here. So you had a good job. And now, if you're not working for the school or the state or a store, they're just getting employment, so you have to drive at least an hour one way to get a job, you know, to work. So in that way, it's less and less people. We try real hard to encourage parents to bring their young kids to activities, but kids just don't want to put the effort into anything anymore. And it's very sad because when they have to come to something, they have fun, they have a good time, but people are just too technologically geared, you know, to that. And so I don't know if it'll always be that way or not, but we can't have, we really struggle to have the activities we have. Just, you know, the festivals and just gatherings and things, public gatherings that we have. But there are still many, many people who like those things. And it may not be children, but it will be young adults, you know, maybe 20, 30, 40 people. And they do like to come to things and have a good time. We still have dances once a month, and then with any of the big festivities, people always expect if you have a dinner, you've got to dance. You know? Mm-hmm. So that's nice. There's just a real lack of energy. But our students, we have a K-12 school that always has about 40 kids in it, mm-hmm. and those kids get a good education and we still have a very, very high incidence of further education after they graduate. Very successful. Yes. And 4-H has always been a real important part of the community. And because classes are so small in the school, that a lot of your lifelong friends are going to be the people you went to camp with. Mm-hmm. And if you did 4-H activities, that's the best friends of my kids, for the most part, are their 4-H friends. Yeah, and well, they have a club here, and then they go to a county camp, and then to a state camp, and they'll have talent contests so you can win in your county, and you can go on to state. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're successful, and they really do well. But I think the kids here, I don't know that there's ever been anything I've called juvenile delinquency that I've even heard of, because you go to a dance, and you may dance with your dad, and with your mother, with your grandma, with your brother. Everybody goes in there just entertaining together. If you have a wiener roast at home, well, your parents are there. The kids don't go off by themselves so much. And I don't know so much even they still do. I think it's just a togetherness that you just don't have in very many places. Yeah, because until you can drive, you can't take yourself from there. Mm-hmm. Because in these kids, these days don't walk. My husband walks a long way to come visit me at my grandfather. But things just keep changing and evolving. And sometimes you want things like they were, but the world isn't like it was anymore. And sometimes you want the same thing, but you don't know how to get there. Mm-hmm. Because if parents can't, if both both parents are working, maybe they can't let their kids be in certain activities because it takes away from the parents' life. I mean, maybe they're not even home to do it. So it would be nice, a lot of things would be nice if you could kind of hold on to some things, but you can't hold on to everything. Well, the 4-H club has a section at the fair, the community fair, and we always made them complete their project. In order to belong to our club, you had to complete the project. Mm-hmm. So, if you got a completer, you might as well work for a blue ribbon, and they did. Very seldom, unless the kid had more than one project, they might get a red ribbon on one of them if they took two or three projects. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of work. 4-H is, and 4-H is a family togetherness, you know. And then the kids, they're in the parade, a lot of them. They folk dance. Some of them sing in our yoga group. So the community fair is something that everybody attends. And a lot of old Helvetia people come from different parts of the state or the country for that. It ended up kind of being a homecoming type thing. And we have this silly little community parade that's just hilarious. And it's just a fun thing to do. And it's nice to keep it up. We always have nice exhibits. There's a lot of produce, flowers, sewing, any handicraft things, photography, just a lot of things for people, and you don't have to be from here, but you have to know when to come and enter it in the fair in order for it to be judged here.
And
anything with the 4-H, a lot of times they have spring wildflowers. You have wildflowers. That'll be a project. West Virginia Trees is a project. Bicycle repair, small engine repair. I guess 4-H is pretty endless. You know, you can do about anything. Not a lot of kids do produce anymore because there aren't that many farms. And I just haven't seen produce things. It's mostly learning about life or something true. You know, maybe they'll take a flower arranging project or making healthy lunches. Oh, yeah. Well, it's pretty standard since I don't have a garden and I don't do much handicraft. I make my own soap, so I take down soap. And apples, we have quite extensive apples and grapes. And if I have done any kind of a handiwork project, that flowers. I have a lot of flowers, so I grow a lot of flowers. I grow flowers. And I just like to go. And, of course, we have a yoga group, so I sing in that, and that's fun. And then there's vendors come, mostly private, small vendors, nothing big. But they'll have woodworking things that they've made that they bring in. Pictures, paintings, drawings, pottery. Sometimes we'll have potters come. And then the Helvetia Archives has the museum open and the archive building so that it's attached to the library so people can see what our heritage was. Mm-hmm. And that's on Saturday and Sunday at the fair hours. Well, Grand Golden is probably my favorite. And that's a West Virginia Grand Golden. That is a West Virginia tree, a native West Virginia tree. And when Stark Brothers found that tree, they were having, they sent out to everybody that they got, they bought catalogs from them and said, do you have a special apple? And this one man in West Virginia said he did, because it had to have certain qualities, like keeping, flavor, texture, whatever. And so they went to his farm, and they decided that that was the best apple. And so that's what has become, that was the root of Golden Delicious.
Okay.
But Grimes Golden, if you get a tin of Grimes Golden, it has a spicy flavor. I like it. We have one over there. My father-in-law found it, and my favorite on the place. So we have russet, garlic, summer scarlet, northern spice. That's all perfect. And that's a big tree. We have a huge tree there. And we have Golden Delicious and Yellow Delicious. And then we have two kinds of pear trees. No, we have three kinds of pear trees. One's a Bartlett, one's a Kiefer, and the other is Sparkling Delicious. It's red, a red kind of pear. So. And then we have a plum tree. Yeah. So, they all need to be, all fruit trees need to be pruned. Yeah, so I have a fellow that probably is going to come pruned this year, but Bruce used to do that, and it's a little far off.
And you're finding about
your fruit. Oh, my. Yeah, we have about 30 feet, maybe 20 to 30 feet of concho grapes. And they bear very heavily most years. And this year we got enough to make, we got, I would say, 550 quarts off of them. And some of it was wine. I didn't make it, but I gave people grapes for wine, but I made grape juice. I didn't have a fresh grape juice. But, it's got more vitamin C than that.
Well,
I don't know that, but always there was an ad that they cut logs, cleared up logs, to build with. And they had the one tool we have here is a funny looking thing. It kind of looks like a harness maker's bench, but it looks like a rail shaving bench, but it's a harness making bench.
Mm-hmm.
And you sit on one end of it, and then it's smooth and long, but you can shape a saddle on or something like that. And the Bellies had stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
because they were very handy with their hands.
Yeah.
They did a lot of things. Everybody used to repair their own shoes, even up until the 60s. In my garage, there's quite a display of glass, from a little baby shoe, and I have to give the shoe for, because we would go to sales, and I would say to Buddy, why don't you buy that? Look how cool that is. And he would say, why do you have that? And then I forget that, and then we'd go to someplace else, and I'd say, well, why don't you get that? He has shoes. And so one day, we were coming home from an auction, and I said, well, if we have all that stuff, why don't I see it? Can't you do something with it so we can see it? Bring it in the house or something. So he decorated the whole end of the garage with it. And you stand there and you look at all this stuff and you go, that's nice.
Well, what
we've
Well,
to hit the pulpit here. You make it with, I think it says the fifth milking from a cow is freshened whenever they have a calf. You can't use the milk for a few days because the milk may be bloody or cloudy. You know, any mother's milk is strange at first, but the colostrum is in there. So it's very powerful, very protein rich, and has the antibodies for not catching diseases, you know, immunity. And so Ella Bentley has a recipe in here for beers, and I think it's kind of like a warm pudding. And her family and her guys have told me it's really good, you know, but nobody does that anymore. I would say that's one that's really long. It's very rich. I only know one.
Yeah.
I only know one. That's why. Yeah. Well, everybody had cows. Yeah. Some had more than one, but mostly, unless you wanted to, like, Berkey's made cheese a lot themselves. I mean, that was part of their financial support. And so they made cheese, probably the most cheese for the longest that I know of. Yeah, everybody had that, and you always had first cream. And, you know, when my son went to the Army, he was highly insulted because they didn't have first cream in the Army. He always put it on his cereal, and he just thought that was the best. So now his wife is on this Tim Healthy Mama thing, and she keeps first cream, so Brian uses it, maybe so. He's not the woman. The reason we make these deep fat fried cheese is because it's like Fat Tuesday. It's before the Lenten fast, they would eat rich food for the last time for 40 days. People don't do that so much anymore as general, but here it was a general thing. They didn't dance during Lent, and they had a big celebration before Ash Wednesday, and then it was shut off until Easter Sunday. The rosettes, I don't even know if that's a Swiss thing. Well, it has to be, because every family has a big rosette iron that they brought from Switzerland, so it must be very important. I didn't realize that when I started making them as a child. But rosettes, you have a rosette iron which you get hot in your deep fat, and then you dip it down in the batter just so that it won't cover the top, because it comes out like a shell. The Hoseblatt are, you make a real rich dough and roll it out real thin, so it's thin enough to be the newspaper, really. And cut it in cut it in whatever size things you want, and deep fat fry that, and then put sugar on. They both have sugar. And we do this because our Fasnacht celebration is always the Saturday before Ash Wednesday, and so that's our big fat Tuesday thing. And there it's a costume ball, and we have some very unique costumes, and we judge the costumes, and people get Swiss flags or prizes, and it's a big dance, and people come from all over the world to it. I don't know. I would guess about 300, and that's pretty much probably capacity for danceability in our hall. Well, of course, we burn Old Man Winter at midnight, and so a lot of people are outside around the bonfire once it's lit about 11 o'clock. So So you have people inside now. But I don't really know how many we have, and I don't know, I've never heard anybody say that I've saved. Yeah, during the dinner we or the dance we set up tables with all kinds of goodies, some fresh things. We have oranges that are cut to eat, and cookies and rosettes and cakes and fresh vegetables and dips and soft drinks. Lard was what everybody had, because when you butcher hogs, you had a lot of lard. Mm-hmm. And now the fatness has been bred out of pork, and so lard's very expensive. You know, I buy lard, I keep lard because I make homemade soap with it, but it's very, very expensive, where it used to be the cheapest thing you could get. And around here, people would butcher in the last 25 years and say, hey, you want my lard? Mm-hmm. And I would render the lard down, you know, to make it myself. But, yeah, I think probably we went to the other because it's just a healthier, you know, if you use canola oil or corn oil or something. Not to beat that side, it's healthy whatsoever. I live on my farm in Hell District, West Virginia.
Thank you very much. Well, is there anything else that I didn't talk about? So this is mostly food related, and obviously agriculture is so important. So
we've made our own comforts for years. You know, you cure your sheep and wash the wool and then part it. And I have a comfort that I made just because I want to experience parting. You know, I thought I can do that. And so I pulled the wool. There's a whole system from when you shear until you get something made out of it. But I did. And you just make these little, some switches, rubblies, like little rugs about this size. And then you butt them up against each other. You don't overlap them. And then you have fabric on the bottom, you lay out this, and then you put fabric on the top, and then you knot and tie it. And they'll last you a long time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you're making them. Mm-hmm.
That's
right, you'd enjoy it.